I rather hastily ran off this sheet just shortly before class. There are several typographical errors. But I think that it still will be an aid, in spite of that, to get the order of thought. It includes material that we've already discussed in very broad outline, and then comes up to where we are at this point, and we go in a little more detail then. We're under Roman 2, capital D. The Ark and the Covenant form of the Old Testament and its historical implications. The present state of affairs in the Deuteronomy debate. And we began discussion of that in the last class hour with Arabic 1, Tzitzin Laban of the Covenant form, historical implications of its presence. With a sub-point, you really could eliminate that sub-point A there because I don't have a B. But the essence of that one is the nature of the covenant form and its origin. Is that to be considered as cultic or historical, the origin of the form? That has come to be a rather debated matter in the present discussion around Deuteronomy in connection with the covenant form. Where's the form come from? And what are the implications of the nature of the form for the origin of the form? And what implications then in turn does that have for the date of Deuteronomy? So that's where we are in our discussion. The nature of the form and its origin, cultic or historical. You might put a question mark after that. Cultic or historical. As we already noticed in our discussion, von Rod, Gerhard von Rod, 1938, proposed the derivation of the form from the cult. At that point, he knew nothing of the Hittite treaties. He knew nothing of the treaty form, but he comes to the book of Deuteronomy. He sees a certain structure in the book of Deuteronomy. We've discussed that earlier. It's contained in his problem of the Hexateuch article. He says that structure of Deuteronomy is a derivative from the cult. In some periodic cultic celebration that followed that pattern has become reflected in the book of Deuteronomy itself. With more recent discussion of the Hittite treaty material, he's not changed his position. In other words, 38, he said there was that structure discernible, it's cultic. 1954, Mendenhall starts with the treaty material, and in the last 15, 20 years, that discussion has increased greatly. Von Rod, of course, is aware of the discussion. He recognizes the very close parallel between the Hittite treaty form and the form that he originally had found in Deuteronomy. So that he says, I'll refer you to two places where he discusses that. The first in his Old Testament Theology, Volume 1, page 132. Now this was published in 1962. So this is rather early on in this treaty covenant discussion. But he says on page 132, comparison of ancient Near Eastern treaties, especially those made by the Hittites in the 14th and 13th centuries BC, with passages in the Old Testament, has revealed so many things in common between the two, particularly in the matter of form, that there must be some connection between these suzerainty treaties and the exposition of the details of Yahweh's covenant with Israel, given in certain passages in the Old Testament. There must be some connection. There's too much of a parallel there for that just to be accidental. As a result, with particular passages and groups of passages, we may speak of what he calls, quote, a covenantal formulation. Covenantal form. Covenantal formulation. In which the various formal elements found in the treaties reoccur feature for feature, though sometimes freely adapted to suit the conditions obtaining in Israel. And then he discusses that schema. We've already seen that outline of the treaties, the outline of the covenant form. And he mentions a number of places that's to be found in the Old Testament. He says, even if there are many questions of detail to be answered, there is at least no doubt that the two kinds of material are related to one another. The relationship in respect of form can be traced down into the text of post-apostolic times. Here, of course, Israel took over. But when we remember the age of some of the relevant Old Testament material, we have to reckon that she became acquainted with this treaty schema very early on, perhaps as soon as the time of the judges. So there is a connection. He says it looks like, because it's of some of the material that it's in, that Israel was acquainted with this form early on in her history, which to him means the time of the judges. Now, getting back to the Mosaic era, back at least as far as the time of the judges. That's about the extent of his comment on the form in his theology. More recently, he's come out with a commentary on Deuteronomy, I've already mentioned. This appeared in German in 1964 and in English in 66. He discusses this at more length here, and I don't want to get into all the details of it, but page 21, he says this. Finally, we must mention one type of composition used in Deuteronomy, which scholars have only recently recognized, namely the formulary used for covenants. The discussion of this has only just begun. It has been known for some time that potentates in the ancient Near East, especially the Hittites, used to draw up their treaties with their vassals according to a definite pattern. But it was astonishing to realize that this treaty pattern can be traced in not a few parts of the Old Testament and amongst others in Deuteronomy. So he sees that pattern there very clearly in Deuteronomy. And then he lists the pattern, all the elements in it. But then he says, at the time of Deuteronomy, this pattern had long been used freely for literary and homiletic purposes. And he discusses that a bit. And then he says, the question is still quite open, how and when Israel came to understand its relationship to God in the form of these early Near Eastern treaties with vassals. So he leaves open the question of origin of the form, and when Israel adopted the form. Over on page 23, he says, if we now ask what Sitzim Laban is demanded by the pattern in accordance with which Deuteronomy is arranged, it can have been taken only from a cultic celebration, perhaps from a feast of renewal of the covenant. Thus, the classic pattern of the regular covenant formulary appears in Deuteronomy, in any case, only in a mutilated form, its setting in the cult, in which the form of Deuteronomy was originally rooted, has in fact been already abandoned in the book as we now have it. That is, because its contents now appear in the form of homiletic instruction for the laity. And, of course, that's in association with his theory of this Levitic preaching as being the origin for the book. And that Levitic preaching is the origin for the book. It's been put in the form of Moses preaching. But the structural pattern, he feels, originally was rooted in the cult and derived from the cult. So that he hasn't really abandoned at all the basic approach to Deuteronomy, which he had in 1938, as far as the structure of the book and its origin is concerned. He recognizes, however, that the treaty pattern is so close to this pattern in the structure of the book that there must be some connection posited. He's not willing to abandon his early theories or to draw any conclusions that would point us back to the Mosaic era for the origin of the form. Now, I would say, and others have said it, I'm not saying anything new in this regard. In fact, I'll appeal to an article of J.A. Thompson. There's good reason to conclude that a cultic origin hypothesis does not provide an adequate or complete explanation for the nature of the form in question. Some sort of cultic origin hypothesis does not give an adequate or complete explanation for the origin of this form. And in addition, it does not answer the fundamental question of the reason for and the time of the initial adoption of the form in ancient Israel. In addition, it does not answer the fundamental question, I think that is the key issue, of the reason for and the time of the initial adoption of the form in ancient Israel. Why did Israel adopt this form, and when did she adopt it? When did it enter into use in Israel? Well, von Rad's not too certain about that. He'll go back as far as Judges as saying there must have been some acquaintance with it. But that's about all he said. Question.
Did you go back to the time of Judges because this is the form that was prevalent and that would have been excellent? Actually, it would have been even earlier than Judges, wouldn't it? From what we see the other day, the development of it.
Yeah, I would think so. And I think in the biblical material, if you take the material as it represents itself to be, say Joshua 24 or the book of Deuteronomy or Exodus 19, you get back earlier than Judges. But what he would say is the material in Exodus, the material in Deuteronomy, the material in Joshua, really later material.
It was all written at the same time. But that as it
was, yeah, that was written after the time of what the Bible represents it to be. Therefore, it became acquainted with the form and the material was put in that form at a later time, but it's not original. J.A. Thompson, who is the author of that commentary that you will read the introduction to, wrote an article entitled The Cultic Credo. And the Sinai Tradition. In the Reformed Theological Review, volume 27, 1958, pages 53 to 54. Now that's a very interesting article. I'm not sure if the Reformed Theological Review is in that library or not. You could check it. And you might find it very interesting to read the article. In discussing von Rad's view that I've just briefly summarized, Thompson says this, and I quote from him, "There seems little reason to doubt that the historical prologue in a secular treatise was a basic aspect of any treaty. Historical prologue in the treaty structure, an essential element." Now we're going to look into that. There's even debate about that, but we'll look into that later. That's an essential element. Little reason to doubt the historical prologue in the secular treaties was the basic aspect of any treaty. Nor need we doubt that it represented, albeit perhaps in some enhanced form, a correct outline of the preceding historical events, which were paraded as a strong argument for the acceptance of the treaty by the vassal. In other words, the historical material in that prologue, it's very important. It appears in all the treaties. It's an essential element. And secondly, it represents real history in the sense of the events that are retold in that prologue provide the basis for the relationship that is going to be established. So it represented a correct outline of the preceding historical events that become a strong argument for acceptance of the treaty by the vassal. The great king says, I've done this, I've done that, I've done the other thing. That's a good reason for the vassal to accept the obligations that are going to be imposed on him. He's benefited. Thompson goes on and says, Von Rad does, of course, take note of the historical recital of the Sinai events when he discusses Deuteronomy in Exodus 19 to 24. But for him, this historical narration is merely a cultic legend of very doubtful historicity. And you see, there's an enormous difference. That historical summation for Von Rad is a cultic legend of doubtful historicity. It's just some story that's really the creation of Israel's faith, if you remember Old Testament history last year, that has nothing to do with events that actually happened. It's a cultic liturgical recital that is the expression of Israel's faith. So that historical prologue is of doubtful historicity. But the question should be asked, Thompson says, whether a cultic legend could serve the purpose demanded in this context. It ought not be assumed that a cultic liturgy should be divorced from underlying historical events. In other words, when you go back to the treaty material, the great king says, I've done this and this and this. Gracious act. That is what evokes the response on the part of the vassal. When you come to the biblical material, if you are going to say that that historical prologue is not really history, and that the previous relationship between the partners, in fact, didn't exist, it's just legendary, what then is the real basis for the response? So I think a cultic derivation view is deficient. The relationship between Yahweh and his people, of which the establishment or renewal is narrated in connection with the appearance of the covenant form in the Old Testament, is connected in a very real sense with the antecedent historical relationship of the covenant partners. I am the one that brought you up out of Egypt, the Lord says. Therefore, the Ten Commandments. It's the reality of that preceding historical relationship that is integrally connected with the establishment of the covenant. So that while such a relationship may be renewed or celebrated in the cult, and Israel did do that, I think that it presupposes a specific historical occasion on which it was originally and formally established, that very relationship, which of course then would point you to Sinai. On what occasion would that have taken place in Israel's history? And it'd be our contention that the Sinai event described in Exodus 19 to 24 provides the most likely setting for the entrance of the covenant form into the experience of ancient Israel, in which the historical prologue is functioning as it does in the treaties. It speaks of real historical events. It provides the antecedent for the relationship that is to be established. So that there's an enormous significance to be attached to the coming to Sinai and entering into covenant there, and the preceding history that went before that is the Lord delivered his people out of Egypt. So that, to come back to the question, sits in Laban of the Old Testament covenant form, historical implications of his presence. The nature of the form and its origin, cultic or historical. I think that on the analogy of the treaty form, you have to conclude that you have strong evidence pointing towards a historical origin for the covenant form, particularly as it's connected with the nature of the historical prologue, which is that which retells real history, not some sort of legendary material that then would not provide an adequate basis for the relationship which is put into this particular form. No.
Said the first the entrance of the covenant tree relationship or form came at Sinai when, mm-hmm. when the Lord gave Moses the law.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's when it first entered into Israel's history.
Yeah. Because what you have there is the Lord himself, by his own choice, establishing a relationship with his people, which seems to follow this legal form, which was known at the time, and was patterned in a certain sense in a similar way. Now, I don't think you could argue for any direct derivation, but I think that it's more the matter that God chose to structure the relationship with his people in a pattern which was familiar to the people from the political realm. And that you then have the Lord coming to his people and saying, I am the Lord your God, identifying himself, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. That's what I've done for you. Now, therefore, you have certain obligations to me, and to those obligations, depending on your obedience or disobedience, the blessings and curses are to be attached. And there was a ceremony for ratification of that. You find all of that in Exodus 19:24. Now, you don't find any detailed sort of correspondence that you could sit down and say somebody was copying the covenant from the Hittite treaty that he may have had before him. I don't think it's that kind of a connection. But a relationship that is structured in generally the same way with the same elements involved. Number two on your sheet, the evolution of the treaty form and its implications for the date of Deuteronomy. The evolution of the treaty form. I mentioned this earlier too, that Klein argues in Treaty of the Great King, page 28, that Deuteronomy is a covenant renewal document which in its total structure exhibits, underline this, the classic legal form of the suzerainty treaties of the Mosaic Age. It's a covenant renewal document which in its total structure exhibits the classic, that's to be underlined, legal form. The classic legal form of the suzerainty treaties of the Mosaic Age. Now, why emphasis on the classic legal form? Because Klein's case is made in part by noting what he calls a discernible evolution in the documentary form of the suzerainty treaties. A discernible evolution in the documentary form of the treaties. And his point is that with that movement in form, and evolution in form, the book of Deuteronomy corresponds with the classic form of the Hittite treaties, which corresponds to the Mosaic era. In other words, that classic pattern in process of time with later treaties, you can see modifications in that classic pattern. Deuteronomy doesn't correspond with the later treaties, say Assyrian treaties or treaties from Sapphira, corresponds with the classic form, the Hittite era. So with this discernible evolution, he says Deuteronomy agrees with the classic stage in the evolution of the treaty form. Now, that raises another point of present discussion, and there's a lot of discussion about this. Do the Hittite treaties of the 14th and 13th centuries exhibit a classic form that does not survive in treaties of a later time? Do the Hittite treaties of the 14th and 13th centuries exhibit a classic form that does not survive in the treaties of a later time? As, for example, in the 8th century Aramaic treaties from Sapphira, now that's on here, S-E-F-I-R-E. It's in North Syria, 8th century. Or the 7th century treaties of Esarhaddon of Assyria. That becomes a matter of importance in Klein's argument, and therefore something I think we ought to look at. If you have later treaties, and the later treaties, say in the Assyrian treaties of the 7th century, are identical in form to the Hittite treaties, well, why wasn't Deuteronomy borrowed from the Assyrian treaties then? In the 7th century, 621 date, that Wellhausen was arguing for. So that becomes a matter of some significance. So, small a, the vassal treaties of Esarhaddon and Sapphira compared with the Hittite suzerainty treaties and implications for the date of Deuteronomy. If you look at the vassal treaties of Esarhaddon, I think you will find that there are certain elements that are much the same as the earlier Hittite treaties. But in spite of some similarities, which you would expect in any treaty, there are important differences. The most important ones, I think, are enumerated here under A, B, and C. First, the absence of a historical prologue. I'd say the most striking and important contrast between the Assyrian and Hittite treaties is that the second section of the scheme in the Hittite treaties, the historical prologue, is not found in the Assyrian treaties. And I think that is enormously important for several reasons. First of all, the historical prologue sets the tone for the Hittite treaties. It's on the basis of his prior beneficent acts that the great king justifies the demand for observance of the stipulations. That's the way the treaty flows. I've done this for you. Justifies then the obligation which the vassal has to him. That historical prologue follows immediately after the preamble in every presently available Hittite treaty. In other words, it's not something that's a random thing, it's in some treaties, it's not in others. It's something that is present in all the presently available Hittite treaties. Now, maybe somebody will dig one up someday that doesn't have it. I ought to add a note at that point. I say it's available in all the treaties. That is a point that is contested. Now, I could refer you to several German works that discuss it all. That probably won't help you much, but D.J. McCarthy, in his book, Treaty and Covenant, that's listed in your bibliography, D.J. McCarthy, Treaty and Covenant, in several places in his book, contests that assertion that it's in all of the presently available Hittite treaties, and argues that several of the Hittite treaties do not have a historical prologue, and consequently, the history was not an essential element of the treaty form. Now, I don't want to go into all the details of that. I think that McCarthy is mistaken. It turns on texts that have things left out. It turns on interpretation of certain texts. It becomes a very complicated question. If you're interested in pursuing it, Herbert Huffman, you can test that statement of McCarthy, H. Huffman, in the Catholic Biblical Quarterly. '27, 1965, 109, 110, discusses that, those statements of McCarthy. And supports the analysis I gave. They all have it. Now, if we had more time, we could perhaps look at a question like that. But at this point, the historical prologue sets the tone of the treaties. It's in all the treaties that we presently are acquainted with. And it introduces in the structure the pronunciation of the loyalty obligation of the vassal to the great king. That's the next element. It introduces the pronunciation of the loyalty obligation of the vassal to the great king. So that the absence of a historical prologue in the Esarhaddon treaties contributes to a very cold, harsh tone that you find in the Esarhaddon treaties. And the wording of those treaties is typical of the ruthless Assyrian imposition of its power on surrounding nations. There's no hint of any merciful Assyrian actions on behalf of the vassals that would merit loyalty and thanksgiving or anything like that. But the blunt declaration of their obligation that's secured by threats and curses, they're not followed. It's quite a different spirit. Yeah. No, they're something in the 20s. And these Assyrian treaties are fewer even. I mean, we're not dealing with enormous bodies of literature here. And I think that ought to be kept in mind in arguments of this sort. Further discoveries may throw quite different bites and angles on a lot of these questions than we have at present. So you want to keep that in mind in any kinds of theories that you build up in this way. Archaeological evidence is fragmentary at best. Drawing conclusions from fragmentary evidence has certain problems connected with it. Yeah.
In my way of thinking, something like this, the liberal trying to move that back down to the Assyrian time,
yeah,
that betrays the theological bias instead of trying to have it. The Old Testament is the bloody God.
I don't know if that enters in or not, but yeah. There certainly is resistance to the use of the Hittite material for a mosaic time of origin. So I'd say in conclusion, the historical prologue is not only an important difference in form, it is that, but it also indicates from the outset a vast difference in spirit between the Hittite and Assyrian treaties. So you get a difference in form and a difference in spirit connected with that form. So that there's quite a different quality of relationship, you might say, between the suzerain and the vassal in the Hittite treaties as compared to that in the Assyrian treaties. Second point, absence of a basic obligation or that loyalty obligation that immediately follows the historical prologue. Of course, the Hittite treaties, not having a historical prologue, it doesn't issue into that. But that also is an extremely important element in the Hittite treaties because that, more than anything else, expresses the spirit of the relationship between the treaty partners. Because of the gracious acts performed in the past by the great king, the vassal expresses his thanks by declaring his allegiance and loyalty. Sort of in lieu of that element in the Hittite treaties, the Assyrian treaties contain an oath of allegiance, which in the structure is in quite a different place. It's after the first section of curses. An oath of allegiance is taken. So that the context becomes one of fear rather than trust. And the relationship then is quite different. Thirdly, absence of blessings, also in keeping with that tone of the Assyrian treaties, another structural difference, no blessings are enumerated whatever for keeping this treaty stipulation. Hittite treaties, that's a prominent element. Assyrian treaties, no blessing. Conclusion then. I think on the basis of these observations, and you could do this in a more detailed way, but I think these are the important things. It seems to me that Klein does have adequate foundation for his assertion that the Assyrian treaties are essentially different from those of the earlier Hittites. I think he does have basis for saying there's an essential difference between the Assyrian treaties and the earlier ones of the Hittites. Now, Klein's not alone in this position. This is not something that's uniquely Klein's idea or that is confined to evangelical authors who discuss these matters. Mendenhall himself agrees, Albright agrees, John Bright in his History of Israel agrees with that, that there's this difference between the Assyrian treaties and the Hittite treaties. Mendenhall in his original article, Law and Covenant in Israel and the Ancient Near East, 1954, said, "This covenant type is even more important as a starting point for the study of Israelite traditions because of the fact that it cannot be proven to have survived the downfall of the great empires of the late 2nd millennium B.C. When empires again arose, notably Assyria, the structure of the covenant by which they bound their vassals is entirely different." That's Mendenhall. Assyrian treaties are different. He notes further, "In all the materials we have, the historical prologue is missing, and only the Assyrian deities are listed as witnesses. The entire pattern is also radically different." So forth. Albright, Stone Age to Christianity, agrees with Mendenhall. He says, "The structure of a half dozen Assyrian, Aramean, Phoenician treaties, which we know from the 8th century BC and later, is quite different." John Bright says the same thing in his History of Israel. So that on that point, Klein has good support. Now, those men don't all draw the same conclusions that Klein does, but they recognize the difference. So, though, even though certain elements are similar, as to be expected in treaties between a greater and lesser power, the similarities are not sufficient to warrant the statement of D.J. Wiseman, who says that the form of the treaties was already standardized by the Hittite Empire and that the vassal treaties of Esarhaddon show that it remained basically unchanged through Neo-Assyrian time. So you see, you get a division of opinion, but it seems to me the weight of evidence is with Klein, Mendenhall, Albright, Bright, that there's this difference. Discernible evolution, quite a different structure, quite a different kind of relationship between the two groups of treaties.
Yeah. Where does Wiseman say that?
That is in his translation of Esarhaddon Treaties, which was published in a journal called Iraq. It's a rather obscure Oriental journal. I could give you the volume and so forth, but it's called Iraq, the journal title. All right, go on to B, or to 2. The Seferi Treaties. We talked about the difference between the Assyrian ones and the Hittite ones. What about the Seferi ones? Now, these treaties are about a century earlier than the Assyrian, 8th century. So they're closer in time to the Assyrian ones than to the Hittite ones, but they're in between. 8th century. 7th century for the Assyrian. Small a, similarities to the Esarhaddon treaties or the Assyrian treaties. And what we're going to notice, just to anticipate, next will be similarities to the Hittite treaties. They have certain similarities in both directions. similarities, first of all, to the Assyrian treaties. With the presently available Aramaic treaties from Sapiri, one finds no historical prologue. Some of the treaties are fragmented at the beginning, so some argue maybe there was one there that we can't see now. But with what is available, there is no historical prologue. Nor is there any statement of that basic obligation. So in those respects, you could say that the treaties from Sapiri are closer to the Esarhaddon treaties than they are to the Hittite treaties.
Sapiri treaties were what empire?
It was a small city-state there with relationships with other lesser powers nearby. But not any major empire. Gives the names of the kings of that city. In addition, it might be said that the stipulations are decidedly one-sided. They regulate the conduct of the vassal toward the more powerful partner, but are not reciprocal. There's very little of obligation of the greater power toward the vassal. In the Hittite treaties, just by way of contrast on this point, there is a solidarity of the two treaty partners, so that the head partner promises protection for his vassal. That's an element, strong element in the Hittite treaties. The head partner promises protection for the vassal. He promises that the enemies of the vassal will be defeated when the vassal remains loyal to his suzerain. Of course, you know, the parallel there with the mosaic material is very interesting too. But both the treaties of Sapphira and the Assyrian treaties lack any such protection clause for the vassal. No protection clause in either the Assyrian or the Sapphira treaty. There are some other points, but we'll leave it with that. For our similarities of the Sapiri treaties to the Assyrian treaties, similarities of the Sapiri treaties to the Hittite treaties. There are certain features of the Aramaic treaties that seem closer to the Hittite treaties. In the selection of gods called upon as witnesses to the treaty, the Aramaic treaties cite the gods of both places, the suzerain and the vassal, the great king and the vassal. The Hittite treaties also name the gods of both partners as witnesses. While the Assyrian treaties name only the Assyrian gods. And in other rather technical points of style of formulation that I won't go into, there's a lot of the phraseology that is closer to that of the Hittite treaties than to that of the Assyrian treaties. In style of formulation, you find certain segments of the Sapiri treaties closer to the Hittite treaties than to the Assyrian. Conclusions regards the Sapiri treaties. They exhibit certain close affinities with the earlier Hittite treaties, but at the same time, important differences, particularly the lack of a historical prologue and basic obligation. And the one-sided nature of the stipulations. I didn't mention that, but the one-sided nature of the stipulations, there are many more clauses which protect the rights of the head partner. in the Superior treaties as compared to the Hittite treaty. Not to exclusion of obligations of the head part, but much more than in the Hittite treaty. Three here, implications of the treaty covenant analogy for the date of Deuteronomy. It would seem to draw this together that present evidence does indicate that the Hittite suzerainty treaties represent a unique early form of the treaty document that is not duplicated in the later treaties either of Esarhaddon or Sapiri. What Klein calls his classic form. And connected with that difference in form is the distinctive spirit reflected in the Hittite treaties. Grounded in the fact that the gratitude and respect of the vassal for the suzerain is an essential characteristic of the treaty relationship. It's quite different in both the Assyrian and the Sapiri treaties. So that Klein, I believe, speaks with good reason of the evolution of the documentary form of the suzerainty treaty. And while the differences should not be exaggerated, and Klein admits that, he says it is indeed one species that we meet throughout Old Testament time. In spite of that one species, in certain parallel elements, there are these differences that can be pointed to. And I think that there is reason to find this discernible evolution. And then Deuteronomy corresponds more closely in its structure and spirit to the earlier Hittite treaties than it does to either the 8th century Sapiri treaties or the 7th century Assyrian treaties. That's the thesis. So Klein's conclusion, page 43 of his Treaty of the Great King, I think has a great deal of merit. Deserves more attention than it's received. And he puts it this way. He says that while it is necessary to recognize a substantial continuity and pattern between the earlier and later treaties, it is proper to distinguish the Hittite treaties of the second millennium BC as the classic form. And without any doubt, the book of Deuteronomy belongs to the classic stage in this documentary evolution. Here then is significant confirmation of the prima facie case for the Mosaic origin of the Deuteronomic Treaty of the Great King. So that's the nature of Klein's argument, and that's the basis on which it rests. And I think he's made a good case. Now, our time is quickly running out, but let me, before getting into responses of some contemporary critical scholars who reject this conclusion and why, just mention J. A. Thompson again. Now, some of you may have already read this. In his commentary on Deuteronomy, that's in the Tyndale Old Testament Commentary series, pages 51 and 52, that's in that introductory section, he expresses reservations about the strength of Klein's argument. Here's what he says. I quote, "The possibility must be allowed that Deuteronomy was cast in the shape of an ancient treaty by someone who wrote long after Moses' day." Someone writing late, putting the material in the form, the earlier form. In addition, he questions the view that the historical prologue was uniquely characteristic of the treaties of the second millennium BC. Citing an article by A.F. Campbell, an historical prologue in a 7th century treaty. Now, as I indicated just a few minutes ago, the historical prologue was in the Hittite treaties. It's not in any presently known 7th or 8th century treaty. Thompson cites an article by A.F. Campbell, an historical prologue in a 7th century treaty. And Thompson then concludes, "Hence, the fact that Deuteronomy has a historical introduction is not necessarily an argument for a date in the second millennium, although it may be. In other words, if you have a treaty back here with a historical prologue, the fact that you have the historical prologue here is not necessarily an argument for this, although it may be. Now, in response to that, I think it should be noted that the historical prologue found by this man Campbell that he cites in the 7th century document is not a clear-cut example. And I could refer you to an article that discusses that and goes into it in detail. A comment by another fellow gets very confusing, an E.F. Campbell, as compared to an A.F. Campbell. Two different articles, two different periodicals. The E.F. Campbell says the reading is far from clear. The one that is suggesting that there is a historical prologue back here. In addition, I think this ought to be noted, that while the possibility that someone cast Deuteronomy in the shape of the treaty form long after Moses' day cannot be totally ruled out, you can't totally rule that out as a theoretical possibility. It's true. Somebody could have, in late time, used the treaty form, put the material in it. You can't rule that out as a possibility. Still, Klein's position is scarcely invalidated in this way, and his model still has a great deal of evidence in its favor. Klein comments in his more recent books, The Structure of Biblical Authority, page 10, quote, if it is once recognized that the Deuteronomic treaty must have been produced whole for a particular occasion, the pervasive orientation of the book to the situation of Israel in the Mosaic Age, and especially the central concern of this treaty with, of all things, the dynastic succession of Joshua, succession Moses-Joshua, always awkward for advocates of the 7th century origin of the book, becomes quite inexplicable for them. In other words, you're going to take the structure of Deuteronomy as a whole, with all that pushes it towards the Mosaic era, and particularly that matter of dynastic succession of Joshua and Moses. That becomes quite inexplicable for someone that wants to hold the 7th century origin utilizing the form back here rather than concluding that the historical setting which the book itself claims to have is not a far better explanation for the origin and use of the form. Well, our time is up. This has taken me much longer than I anticipated because I wanted to discuss, before your presentation starts, this matter of centralization of worship. And I only have three more class hours. No, I only have two more class hours. I may not make it, but...
What's the open class?
Yeah, maybe... I figured that even in our presentations, time has a way of going by so quickly and you get jammed up, and I was certain that we were going to need some time to get caught up with one thing or another, so I left a couple open hours. Well, next class hour we'll look at the responses of some contemporary critical scholars who reject this conclusion. Where do they go with this model?